Wallet Show this week, ETF pricing. Hi, I'm Christia. With me as always, Simon Brown. How's it going?
It's going excellently.
I don't see your thinking cap on. I think you're going to need it today.
Ooh.
If you're new to this podcast, please be warned that a bleeped version of the show is available at justonelap.com. Thank you to Sean for making that happen for us. Wonder if Sean will have moved by this point.
I think he has. I don't know about his family. It's a hard question. I have an old person hangover. Which means
you just have a hangover.
I didn't drink enough to qualify for a hangover, but somehow I have one. Here I am.
Oh, man. All right. So I want to look at the Fat Wallet Price Weighted Index to look at its performance, but then I want to keep that open because I want to use that as an example of how we would price this if it were an ETF. So I think that that's a really good way to go about it. Our topic this week is inspired by Ben, who is not sure about selling ETF units, so we'll get to that in a second. We will be in October on Halloween. It is not a mask, it really is us, but you are welcome to dress.
Of course it's Halloween.
You're welcome to dress as your favorite ETF for the night if you want to join us in Cape Town. For a live fan. I wonder how you would even do that. You would have to wear so many things, like imagine the 1200.
You just wear a hat of the planet, like a...
Ooh, that's cool.
Like a globe on your head.
That's really good, but then you have to scratch out Africa. Because that's not in that.
Yeah,
you'd
have to scratch out Africa and put an Ashburton badge somewhere on you.
Oh, man, please do that. That would be amazing. We're going to do a live recording of the show at the JSE in Cape Town on the 31st of October is actually the point. So if you're in Cape Town, please come join us. We never get to record there. We never get to spend any time in Cape Town. So please.
Well, the only reason we're spending time is because SAA cancelled their 9 o'clock flight home.
Which means we should all go out to dinner afterwards.
Sure. I was thinking more along the lines of drinking, but and then I'll probably have an 8 o'clock flight because I'm going to get back to Joburg for TV.
Oh, man. And then you can't have an old person, and you will be a year older by that point
as
well. I
will be a year older.
It's like the day after your birthday that we're recording that, which is great. It's like a little birthday party.
So I'm basically going to be hungover for about 4 or 5 days, and I have a cunning plan on how to solve that problem.
How?
Just don't stop drinking.
My birthday hangover lasted from Sunday to Wednesday this year. It was brutal. Very brutal.
Yeah, okay, you got no capacity. I'm just going to do Churchill, and I'm just going to go from Wednesday morning through to sometime on Sunday.
Yeah, just a consistent buzz.
Yeah.
The problem with me is I never maintain the consistent buzz. I always peek out of it, and then I forget what happens.
Hold on, some practicals. 5:30 at 155 Campground Road. If you want to be fancy, you can go and book at justonelap.com/events.
And don't forget to bring wine.
Bubbles.
And your hat.
Your hat.
All right. So our price weighted index is down 3.4%, which is hectic. But the Satrix 40 is also down 1.5%. So far, I would say we are the Satrix 40 does about twice as well as we do since we started this. Wouldn't you say? It's been pretty consistent.
Yeah, a little better than twice. But yes, the Satrix 40 is more or less kicking our ass. But twice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I want to say we can only hope that NASPASH would do poorly or Capitec, but we don't hope that really because this is just for funsies and the other one we're invested in.
So. We actually have real money in.
Yeah, let's not hope for bad things to happen.
There's been some horror moves here.
Let's see what's happening. Who's hurting us the most?
So Wilson Bailey, who would have thought? That's top performer. City Lodge.
What is Wilson Bailey?
They build bridges.
Is that WBO?
Yeah.
Okay. Man, and even that, like a top performer, because with the Listener Love Index, top performance was like Kumba at 70%, sometimes 80%. This is only 32%. So even for a top performer, it's not really helping us much.
It's less than 2 months old, but yeah.
Mm-hmm. But check City Lodge down 21%. And ShopRite down to it. Yes, you must be suffering at the moment.
My portfolio is having
not a nice time.
Yeah, because Richemont's in it as well, down 13 and change. My portfolio is having about its worst year relative to the market in since I think 2002.
Yeah. This is not pretty at all. I mean, because this, even though this index excludes all the really high-priced companies and the the really cheap ones, this is a fairly good indication of what's happening in the market as a whole, which is why we made this index in the first place.
Well, no, because it's down 3.4 versus 1.6.
But I mean, like, what is the, like, in terms of a feel of the market as a whole? There's definitely not, like, even the ones that aren't in the negative, very few of, no, none of them are up except for the one over 10%.
Yeah.
Like, literally not a one that I can
see. No, this is
it's brutal. And everything that's negative is, like, over 10%. Well, not everything.
I mean, the market right now is ours and everybody else, the US and everybody else. They're looking, frankly, they're looking
it's not great.
I mean, yeah, the FTSE was off 3.25 yesterday. Nikkei was off 2.
Even Zach's index is down, like, almost 10% at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's really harsh.
Mm-hmm.
We should actually add to Zach's index the Satrix 40 as well, from when we made his index, so that we can see how he does relative to the Satrix 40. Because the Satrix 40 reporting that we see, the number that we see is also ex-dividends, right?
Yeah, so it's ex-div, so it's fairly like for like.
Yeah. So we should add that. All right, so let's get to Ben's question, and then I want to talk about how we determine ETF pricing. Because in the market, normally how it works with a normal company is there's a person who says, I'm willing to sell at this price, and another person or entity who says, I'm willing to buy at this price. And you kind of get to what the price is depending on those two factors. But in an ETF, which is made up of all these little companies, it doesn't work that way. So with an ETF, we use the net asset value, which is more difficult to understand in an ETF than it is in a normal company. Because in a normal company, you can actually refer to physical stuff. So you can say the net asset value of this company is X because they have this building and they've got this much inventory, et cetera, et cetera. But with an ETF, it's harder to do. It's harder to determine.
See, I disagree. I think it's harder because an ETF has got that share. What's the price? What's the value of that share? Well, it traded in the market, and therefore that's its value. That building, what's its value, will get me 10 estate agents and I'll get 12 prices.
So it's funny that you say that, because before you came, I was thinking about this, and I was thinking the value of a building is what we were saying the other day, is what somebody is actually willing to offer for that building. So it's not actually because there's a difference between what the estate agent says it's worth, mm-hmm, and what the person is willing to pay. So in that regard, it actually works exactly the same as the market.
Well, yeah, except that when last did that building transact? I mean, you bought your flat a year ago. I bought mine 2 years ago, which means the prices of our respective buildings are 1 and 2 years out of date, whereas the shares have probably traded while we've been talking.
So it's interesting. If you want to know the true net asset value of your building, you should not ask what the estate agent says your building is worth or what the city says your building is worth. You should ask what somebody's willing to pay you for it. So you should ask for offers, which is, like, a very cumbersome way to go about finding out what
house. And that's just it. And you know, so the market gives us it gives us price discovery, which we don't have. And even with buildings, our price discovery is very weak because there's only one seller and one buyer. Maybe you get two or three buyers, but typically one seller, one buyer. So your price discovery is fairly fake as well.
But this is so difficult about share investing in general. So a few weeks ago, I did a presentation at Open Window. It's the second one I've done there. And I go there and I talk to the third year students about the five concepts to make you rich.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to explain. So I start the presentation with what even is the stock market. Then you start with the thing like, okay, a company goes to get to sell ownership, to raise funds, and that's, you know, so basically that's how I start that conversation. When the company goes to market, to the primary market, to sell ownership, the value of that share is more determined by the company than it is by the buyers. Because the company goes in there and says, these are buildings, these are assets, et cetera, et cetera. This is what the company is worth, and we're going to market at this price because of the underlying value. But that's the last time that the share price is actually any sort of reflection of the net asset value. After that, once it goes to the secondary market, it is only supply and demand that determines the share price, which is incredibly difficult because supply and demand is incredibly fickle. Like sometimes it's influenced by news reports, sometimes it's influenced by rumors, sometimes it's influenced by, you know, like it's part of a group of shares that do something on the market. So it becomes incredibly difficult then to explain to people who have a tenuous grasp on what the share or what the stock market is to begin with, why share prices move all the time,
mm-hmm.
right? And if you don't understand why share prices move all the time, it's going to be extra hard to understand how an ETF is priced. Because you say, okay, the net asset value of an ETF is this share price plus this share price plus this, but it's not, because then the share price would be enormous. It is all those added together, and you know, there's some what is it, mathemagicianing happening in the background.
Yes.
And so I want to get to that. All right, but let's get to Ben's question first. He says, when is it a good time to sell an ETF? On Easy Equities, it seems that you can only use a market order and sell at the particular unit price at that point in time. They have no option for a limit order. What is a limit order?
So a limit is when you say, I want to buy or sell, but that price or better. Whereas a market order is just buy or sell at whatever I can in the market.
Right. And so I think it's important to understand here why there's no option for a limit order. Like, so you can probably do limit orders for ETFs, but you have less control there than you would for an ordinary share because of how ETFs are priced.
Yeah, so I do limit orders for ETFs anyway, just because I worry that the market maker will suddenly disappear in the second I hit the buy button and I will get a crazy price.
Right.
So they're
with ETF, that with Easy Equities, they don't buy your ETFs right away. They normally pool all of they give you the average price for the day.
So the HQ right now, there's a seller, the market maker selling at 47.23, and I would put a limit in at say 47.25. I would get the 23, but just in case they suddenly disappeared, I don't want to buy from the person behind them at 51.
Yeah. Okay. He says, would you say this is a major issue in that you're forced to take the price right then? So let's just talk about how Easy Equities buys ETF.
Yeah. So what they do, and they do this with all of this is how they're able to offer not so much the 0.25%, but how they're able to offer the no minimum, because you'll notice every other broker has a minimum. And they also do that on things, for example, your straight fee, which is some $12 and change, and they just prorata it to you, etc. And the reason that what they're able to do is you come along and you want to buy the HQ and you say, please buy it for me. And they see a seller at 47.23 in the market. So they give you that 40. They say, sure, you've bought them at 47.23, but they don't buy them for you. Later in the day, they go and get your ash order and theirs, and they get all the orders together and hit them into the market at one time. Now, they do that because little 50 Rand orders are going to cost, I mean, the minimums, once you've got your, I mean, the JSC is about 12 Rand a hit per minimum, plus your straight, etc. It's about $30 of fees in that transaction. You've just done a $50 transaction. They've made nothing. They're hoping to get lots of $50 transactions so that they can get a couple of thousand Rand together and do it at one time.
So can we use an example like in the real world? Like if you had to go to a store and do something like this, what would that be?
No, we can't.
So
you've given this thought. My brain is whirling.
No, I mean, I haven't come up with an example, but I'm assuming like if you say like a coffee shop, for example. You know, some people come into a coffee shop and they buy coffee and they buy food and they buy everything else. It's not like every time you go to a coffee shop, they have to go and buy beans just for you.
Yeah.
You go, so I come in and I buy one coffee.
In advance.
Yeah. And you go and you buy a coffee and lunch for 10 people or whatever. They've got all the stuff there and they do it, you know, they don't go out and buy everything at, you know, which is how it would. Am I making sense?
Yeah.
Is it a good example? It's an okay example. It's not a great example.
You're not going to win any Sunlam Awards for it.
I'm wondering, you know, probably tonight when I'm lying in bed, I'm going to come up with the best example.
So check the show notes, because Christy will add them into the show notes. But there's an extra point quickly on the easy equity. So they gave you 47.23 on the Ashburton Qs, and then they go later in the day and they buy it, and the price might be higher or late or lower, and that's for their risk or reward.
Yeah.
Yeah. So if they have to buy, if they end up, if the market falls and they get it at 47, they make the 23 cents. If it rises and they get it 48, they make they pay the extra money. That's not for your risk.
And so why don't they buy the stuff ahead of time? Why don't they just buy a bunch of Ashburton EQs and then keep it in?
Because they don't know what peeps are going to want. They don't know what you want. Whereas the coffee shop knows what you're going to want. And coffee shop takes risk. They go and buy, I don't know, Cornish pastry, and no one wants their Cornish pastry, and they've got to give it away or something, or discount it or something like that. So they take that, coffee shop takes risk. Now, on their coffee, no, because they're a coffee shop, but on those peripherals. So, you know, if they went and they could, I mean, they've probably got enough stats now, and they could probably pick the, you know, 10 or 15 most popular ETFs and buy some in advance, but there's no real benefit to them because they can hit it as they need it, you know, as you want.
But so regardless of whatever they pay by the end of the day, if you came in and it was 23 cents, you're going to get it at 23 cents. You're not going to buy, you're not going to get it or less.
What they could be doing, and they're not, but they, as far as I understand, is they could be doing bookovers with the ETF issuer. So at 4 o'clock, they could go to each issuer and say, I need that much, or, you know, so much of this one, that one, and the other one, and book it through the JSE. They would still get the prevailing price at that point in time. So it wouldn't save them in that sense. And it's just, they just go hit the market.
Okay. So Ben says, is it better to wait and buy in at an opportune time each month, as opposed to a monthly debit order that will buy at a unit price that may be suboptimal?
Yeah. So I'm going to give a long answer to a short question. In the olden days, it used to be better to buy a couple of days after month end. So my debit goes off, and now I can't remember. My niece chose it. I think my debit goes off on the 6th of every month. And the reason being is because often you would get some ramping up of prices at the end of the month, particularly end of the quarter, because the unit trust folks want their returns to look better. So they go find the share they've got a big holding in that's got a low liquidity, and they quickly go buy some, push the price up, and get a better looking performance for the quarter. They'll all deny it, but that's what they used to do. That no longer seems to be happening as much as it used to be happening, and for reasons I'm not sure of. So in that sense, my buying on the 6th is moot. I just leave it, because as I said, my niece chose the date, and maybe it's magic. Are there better times otherwise to buy? Well, sure. I mean, so today we're recording on Thursday was definitely a better day than to buy any other day this week, because we've been falling. But now you're trying to time the market, and that becomes, you know, truthfully after, so I think Monday we were nice and, was it Monday? One of the days we were nice and green, then lots of red days, you know, how low down can it go? How high can it, and truthfully what happens, and we've had this conversation before, the trying to time the market, you know, it's the idea of I'm going to sit on cash, and when it falls 30%, I'll buy. Buying a market that's fallen 30% takes serious courage, because it's just fallen 30, and what happens if it's going to fall 40 or 50? So you wait for it to fall, and then it falls, and then you're like, ooh, maybe it'll fall more. Ooh, maybe the world is ending. Ooh, what's the orange one saying? And so you don't buy, and then it jumps, and then you pan, and you know what? You're spending a vast amount of time and a vast amount of energy, and you're unlikely to get better pricing. I mean, I've been a trader for 20 years, and I am finally getting a proper grasp on pure price action and the like, and it's been a 20-year journey.
So Ben says, how often is an ETF repriced? Is it only done once a day at a particular time?
So no, short answer, not. The indices are repriced, I think, every second. I'm busy watching. Yep, the index is being repriced about once a second, and the ETF will then reprice as that changes. Now, of course, the index I'm looking at as I'm speaking has just gone from 81.6 to 81.2 to 81.9, you know, those changes are tiny, they're fractions. And that's going to have no bearing on the ETF. That's a rounding error in the background. But in the next 5 minutes, it might go, well, now it's just gone to 85, 858, 859. At some point, it'll move to a level where the ETF will change. So the ETF pricing has been done in real time relative to the index. The index has been updated per second, and it might even be quicker than that. And that index is then doing it on the shares, and the shares are updating as trade is happening. A stock like NASPAS, there are billions of rands going through every day, so there's change all the time. A small little stock like, pick a small stock, there might only be, there are stocks out there that are like doing 10 trades a month. Now, they're not in ETFs because they're so small.
So why would a company like NASPAS have like billions of trades in a month?
A couple of reasons. One, because it's a large market cap, so it's got a heavy weight in our index. It's about 20% of our market. So if you're a fund manager, you're probably going to have a lot of NASPAS. You're probably going to have somewhere between 5 and 15% of NASPAS, whereas other shares, you're probably having somewhere between 1 and 5%, but also because of its size and because of its liquidity and transaction value that's happening, a lot of traders are also sitting in the NASPAS space.
So can you explain how traders make money on the price movement versus how investors make money on the price movement?
Well, they make it the same way. They just make it in different time frames. So a trader, so NASPAS is currently offered at 226,393, and if you buy it now and you hope to sell it back and you're looking to make $2, $10, $5, whatever the case may be, you're not looking to make a massive amount of profit, partly because you bought 100,000 rands worth of NASPAS, but you only put 10,000 rand down. In other words, you basically only put a deposit. So your profit is 1%, but you only put 10% down. So you actually effectively made 1 times 10, which is you made a 10% profit. And traders will also make money by going short, which is selling what they don't own. And then you borrow the shares, you sell them into the market, you buy them back and you return them to the owner and you make profit from a fault. But they're doing it in significantly shorter time frames. You know, I look at typically my investing charts are on a weekly basis. These traders are looking at what we call a tick chart, which is updating every second.
So if you guys are wondering how you can sell a share that you don't own, you may have noticed in your ETF, when you look at fact sheets, minimum disclosure documents, you may have noticed something, they disclose it, and I know Satrix does this, they say this ETF or this company engages in script lending. And basically what that means is Satrix have all these shares in NASPAS because they have the Satrix 40 and NASPAS is a big holding there. And so they lend those shares to traders to go and sell in the market. But then like there's a whole thing. So Simon did an excellent series on CFDs and how they work. And we get into some of this stuff there. So you can find that on justonelap.com. So it's like a special financial vehicle that you need to do that. You can't just do that your own portfolio.
You'd be using derivatives or you could phone up Satrix and borrow shares. But like if you ain't...
Phony Lena, be like, please, can I have 2 NASPAS shares?
Yeah, you see, the two part's going to stop her for a moment. She's going to say, add some zeros. And what happens when you borrow the shares is 2 things. Firstly, you now owe Satrix want that dividend. So if NASPAS pays a dividend while you're holding it, you got to pay it over to Satrix. And further to that, you then pay a fee to borrow the shares.
Yes, and then the risk that you take is that you borrowed that share at a certain price and then the price falls.
Well, no.
The price rises.
Yeah. Sorry. So the price and rises you
have
on
to,
you.
And then you have to pay back more than you borrowed.
And the problem with shorting is that your downside is unlimited. Because if you own a share, the most you can lose is 100%. It goes to zero. You lose 100%. Nasty. If you have sold a share you don't own, it could go up multiple folds. And so you can lose. And we saw it with, I think it was Porsche. There was a Porsche, was a Porsche that was listed, etc. And we call them a short squeeze, where there'd been a lot of short sellers. Then something with Volkswagen, some takeover, I forget the details. And the Porsche price jumped about 100%. So all the short traders had to go and buy shares, which caused it to jump a whole lot more, which then caused all the traders out there to get excited. Porsche went up 400%, which means that some traders just got wiped out. Just like, and when I say wiped out, I don't mean they lost all their money. I mean, they lost more than all their money.
So this is when you hear on TV or sometimes you'll hear somebody lost all their money on the stock market. This is how it happens.
Like, yes.
You can lose all of your investments on the stock market for sure, but it's very unlikely that you'll lose all your money and your house and, you know, your cat and everything unless you do this.
And even to lose all your money, you need to be in a special sort of, you know, risk zone, you need to have bought Steinhoff, or, I mean, even with Steinhoff, I mean, it's now trading at $1.06. I mean, you haven't lost all your money. You've lost 99 point something.
Yeah, just of your investment, not your money.
Correct, of your investment. It you know, that's why we do ETS, because there's a basket. And as we have said many times, we owned Steinhoff when it went pear-shaped, and
I mean, fine.
You can't even see that blip on the top 40 chart. You can see it in the Steinhoff chart, but not in the top 40.
All right, so let's look a little bit at so you've said that share prices, people, so the reason why share prices move in the secondary market, so remember before I was saying when a company goes to market, there's like the share price there is a fair idea of what the company actually has. So it's not just like the buildings and the supply and stuff, but also like what they think that they can make in the future. And there's like a whole bunch of numbers in the background there.
By secondary market, you mean the JSC. That's what we trade on.
Yeah. Yes. So the primary market is like, you guys may have heard of an IPO. That's something, if you watch Silicon Valley, that's really what it is all about. It means like when a company goes to the stock market to raise money to grow the company, that's an IPO. And the price of a share there is determined by the company.
Yes.
And
with help from their bankers. And bankers.
So, okay. But then the minute the company is not selling the share to you as an investor directly, the minute you buy the share on the market from somebody else, like an anonymous trader on the market, that's what we call the secondary market. Mm-hmm. And the share prices on the secondary market have almost nothing to do with the underlying company. Like, it is so random sometimes.
In the short term, it has nothing to do with the underlying company. In the long term...
Oh, that's a good point.
In the long term, it will broadly track it. You know, it will... You know, if a company's profits have tripled over a 10-year period, the share price, including dividends, would broadly have gone up threefold over that 10-year period. In the short term, it's not. It's worried about all shades of panic. So I'll give you an example. When a few weeks ago, when Saudi Arabian oil refineries were attacked, and so, you know, 5% of the world's oil is no longer available for the market, so oil spikes. But the whole, so oil price goes up like 10-15%, and then markets fall. Why? Well, because now we're worried about war in Iran or Saudi Arabia, or markets are suddenly just scared, and then there's no war. So it's like, oh, okay. And then oil goes back, and then markets go and find something else. And they're like a puppy. You know, like a 6 week old, markets are like a 6 week old puppy. You put them on the floor and they will sniff a million different things, and everything they sniff is the most important thing in the world for about 3 seconds, and then their mind goes somewhere
That's
else.
A really great
analogy. And they rush off again. And markets are exactly the same.
But I quite like the idea of using commodities to illustrate this point, and gold specifically, because the gold price is mad, right? It just moves all the time, and there's no reason for it. I mean, gold has very little utility value, although it does now, but it never used to have.
Well, it's useful for rings and circuitry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I mean, like, this, even the circuitry thing is new-ish in the history of people trading gold.
And truthfully, you only really put gold in your circuit if, like, you're going to Mars. Like, if you're just making a, you know, like a fridge or a cell phone, you know, like something like, if it's critical circuitry. Like, if you go to Mars and your circuit breaks, you're in trouble. If your cell phone circuit breaks, now you can't
go to the Instagram. Okay, so there's a lot of price movement in the market that has nothing to do, or very little to do, with the underlying company in the short term, right? However, ETF prices are not determined in the same way. And that's what I kind of want to get to. So let's use our price weighted index as an example. So we have how many? 36. Yeah. We have 36 shares in our price weighted index. They all have different share prices that go up and down all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say we had to build an ETF on top of this. How would we get to this?
Well, so what we would do, because this is equal weighted, because it's price weighted, and therefore we just stuck each stock in once. So whereas with NASPAS, sorry, with the top 40, your $100 goes 22 Rand to NASPAS and 12 cents to Woolly shares, and so it goes through. Here we just said, well, these 36 shares, we're just going to buy one of each. Boom, 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 and put them into a basket. What happened, though, if we buy one of each, it cost us 5,206 Rand and 4 cents, which is a slightly expensive ETF. Now, truthfully, it's neither here nor there, but, you know, there's some peeps who just don't have 5,000.
Can I just cut in here? If you guys had to go and take this Fat Wallet price weighted index, go to the market, buy one share of each, at the end of the day, you would have spent 5,206 Rand and 4 cents.
Yeah, excluding transaction fees.
Excluding transaction fees and depending on when during the day you buy.
So it would have cost you 5,200, and peeps look at that and think, that's expensive.
Yeah.
So what we would have done is we would have used a 100 divisor. In other words, we would have said, well, okay, the index is 5,200, whatever. It's actually 520,604 cents. We would have used a divisor and said, well, why don't we divide it by 100? In other words, every share in that basket is 1% of a share rather than a 100% full share. And then our price of the ETF would have been 52 Rand and 6 cents, 0.04, but we can round that off, no problem. And now we've got an ETF trading at 52.04.
But then,
06, sorry.
What about if you and I are now the ETF issuers? We still need to put the money in the market because we can't buy 1% of a share. We have to buy the whole share.
Sure. So what we would have done, and just a quick point, I want to go to Satrix 40. So you'll notice Satrix 40 is trading at 49 Rand 24, 48 Rand 51 rather. The index is 48,510. So what they've done is a divisor of 10. In other words, they've put 10% of every share into that rather than 100% into that and used the 10 divisor. So correct.
So how do we determine if we're going to use 10 or 100?
Well, just on the price. If I use 10, my ETF would have been 520 Rand, and that's still expensive. So let's make it 52 Rand. And in fact, the Ashburton Midcap, they changed their divisor because it was trading at 60 odd Rand, and apparently people didn't like that. So they... Am I correct on that? Let me double check myself. And so they just increased their divisor and basically...
Yeah, so it doesn't have to be 1% or 10% or whatever. It can be anything.
Typically, it's going to be 10 or 100 or 1 or something, but it can be absolutely anything. So the Ashburton was trading at 80-odd Rand or whatever it was, the Ashburton Midcap. And then they're like, yeah, no one likes this. So they sliced it down and they made it trade at 8 Rand.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what do I do then as the ETF issuer? Do I need to put up the money, essentially.
Yeah, so you've got to put up some cash. And the point being is, so they can't go and buy 1% of a share, but they're hoping to. So they would do typically they would do an initial, it's kind of an IPO, but not quite an IPO. But they say, Core's coming out with their new ETF in November, their property one at the end of November. And what they're going to do is they're going to be roadshowing it and stuff. And they're going to say to folks, give us money in advance and we will give you the ETF on listing day. And if you say at what price, they'll say, I'll tell you on listing day. And there's a complex process how it works in the background. You get a letter of allocation, which is your right, and then on the day you swap that for the ETFs.
But you just
gave them money.
You actually don't have to do anything. Like, this happens all in the background.
This happens all in the background.
So you just basically say, cool, give me some of that, and then on the day, there it is.
There it is. And when you see phrases like letters of allocation and stuff, it's just the technical part behind it, so don't stress that. So what we would do is we wouldn't just go and buy 1% of every share. We wouldn't even just go buy one of every share, because that would give us 10 ETFs. So we would go and roadshow this, and we would raise, because it's a really grand index, but it's not.
It is really grand.
Aside from performance, it's a really grand index.
This index is teaching me so much about the market. It's wonderful.
And like how not to make
indices. This is a school fee.
So we would go out there and roadshow it, and we would do fancy lights and all of those sort of things, and rah-rahs, and you know, champagne
dances
and marshmallows and dances. Would we scoop as low as dances?
Hey, there's nothing wrong with dancers.
Oh, okay. Okay. So when you, me and you, when you say dancers, different things come into our minds. You're different professions. And so we would have some professional dancers and the like. And
ballerinas,
there we go.
Tango dancers.
And we would raise like billions of za. And sure. then. And then our listing date would be on the Excellenti of November. And the day before, we would go and buy all the shares and put them in their little baskets and stuff and then give them to you the next day at whatever the price that we had bought them at.
Okay. Mm. No, surely not the price where we bought them. Surely the price that that what you benefit as a person who comes in
well, at the primary listing? Well, no. So if the ETF is listing on the Monday morning at 9 o'clock, I buy the shares on Friday. I buy them at a value, and I'm going to give them to you at that value because I'm not taking the risk.
So, and also then that is the only benefit as an ETF buyer. That's the only time where you could possibly make a little bit of money on an ETF.
Yeah, but you might lose as well.
You might lose, but if you buy on the Friday and by the Monday morning all those shares have gone up, yay.
Sure.
If you buy on the Friday and by the Monday all those shares have gone down,
your only real score is that you don't pay brokerage.
Yes.
Yeah. You don't pay any of the brokerage or anything like that.
I mean, so there's one real tangible benefit and then there's a potential benefit.
Yeah, or
and which
risk.
Which is really the only reason why you would go in when an ETF comes to market initially, as opposed to when a company comes to market.
So, I mean, if you're doing – so ETFs don't pay STT and it depends on transactions. But even if you go to Easy Equities where it's moderately cheap, if I were using my broker, if you're doing 100,000 transaction, the fee's going to be 600-800 rand to buy that ETF. You save 600-800 rand. That's two bottles of nice bubbles. Mm. Four if you want to be like moderately cheap.
Yeah. If you have a bubble man, which you absolutely should. So I came up with a really good analogy for the ETF pricing model. A person who makes shirts, like let's say you're a person who makes dress shirts, and one person comes in with an order for 10, the other person comes in with an order for 1. By the end of the day, you go buy the material. You don't buy the material up front because then how much.
Yes, so you buy for 11. Yes.
And then the person who, like maybe you as the supplier of the shirt get a bit of a discount because you're buying in bulk and you don't pass that discount on to your things.
Yeah.
Huh? I didn't even have to sleep on that one. Mm-hmm. It just came to me. All right. So we have decided that you were looking at the wrong price before. We have decided that our ETF will be priced at 50 Rand and 28 cents.
So I was looking at the listing price from 7 August.
Yeah. And you should be looking at the live price
today.
Because you were looking at the live price for Satrix.
Sure.
You went, yeah.
Okay. Yes, yes. All right. Yes, yes.
So we have gone out, we had an IPO for our ETF. Mm-hmm. We went out, we bought a bunch of them. Now they're in the market. And now from now on, why don't those just trade on the secondary market like a normal share?
What, the ETF?
Yes.
It does.
Yeah, but why is the market maker involved in the cost of the ETF?
So what there is, and market makers are not unique to us, but for example, in the US, you might see market makers. So the point is, anyone can be a market maker. Me and you could go and be a market maker for Satrix. And in fact, if I look at Satrix 40, there's usually a couple of market makers floating around because, you know, you can go and buy and sell it in open market. I can see at least two market makers on the sell side and maybe three on the buy.
So let's explain what a market maker is.
So what a market maker is our ETF is currently priced at 50 Rand and 28 cents. I'm rounding it up.
That, so did I.
That is its fair value, its net asset value. That is what it is currently worth.
So again, just to recap, I know we've just said this, but just to recap, we've added together all of the prices of all the underlying shares. Mm-hmm. We divided it by 100 to get to a price that's actually affordable to people. And that's how we got. So we say the fair value is kind of an inverted commas because it just means the value of the prices of the underlying shares.
Not the shares in that basket.
And it has not necessarily anything to do with the value of the businesses inside the shares.
Correct. Yes.
So the net asset value of the share price of an ETF is not the same as the net asset value of a company.
Correct. Yes. All right. So then, and then, so the market maker. So we've got 50 rand 28 cents is the value. So what we do is it's 50 28. So we would go into the market and we would be a buyer at, are we going to be a nice or a mean?
Let's be mean.
Let's be mean. So we're going to be a buyer at 50 rand and we will be a seller at 50 65.
Yeah, that's super mean.
No, come on.
I was going to go like 1 cent up and 1 cent down.
That was kind. I'm being nasty. So what that means is that if you want to buy this ETF from us, we will sell it to you at 50.65. You will note that is 17 cents above its net asset value, and that's income for us. We need to make, and the market maker wants to get paid. There's some trading fees for us as well because we've got to transact on the market. And
the market maker also pays,
they pay that brokerage too. Now, the JSC is looking at a theory where if you are hit, you don't pay. In other words, or you get a discount and that will benefit market makers. So I'm sitting there as market maker. You buy from me and then I maybe get a discount or something to try and encourage market makers in that space. But and then if you want to sell, I'm there buying it at 50 bucks and it's worth 50.28 and that 28 cents is my profit again and I'm going to scoop that in. But as that fair value changes, so in a week's time, it's now worth 52 rand because finally our methodology starts to work. We would be sellers at say 52.25 and would be buyers at say 51.75. So as that net asset value of the ETF is moving up and down and that is changing in real time, we are adjusting our market making at the same time to always be, say, 25 cents either side. And we would be there with 50,000 ETFs to sell. And as soon as you bought 10,000 from me, I'd add another 10. So I've always got 50,000 in the buy, 50 in the sell. Now, that 50,000 is a number that we decide. I mean, we could do, you know, I'm noticing on Satrix is one of the market makers is at 100,000, the other one's at 25,000, and then the other one's at 5,000. I mean, you pick your market maker volume.
But then there's also potential for me and you to go into the market and to say, hey, you want to offload some of your mm-hmm. price-weighted stuff. The market maker wants to charge me like 50 rand. What did you say?
They're buying it 50
rand, 50, yeah. Right? But you are willing to sell to me at 50 rand, yeah. 27. And so there is like a secondary market. Why?
So what happens is that let's go back to our original buyers at 50 rand, sellers at 50.65. That's us, that's the market maker. But someone can come along and say, well, I want to buy, but I don't want to buy at 50.65. I'm going to put a limit order in at 50 rand and 18 cents. Why? Because that's 10 cents cheaper than it's worth. That's a discount for it. And I go put my order in at 50 rand and 18 cents. And then I wait to see if somebody will come and trade to me. Now, that somebody might be you who've got some ETFs who sell them to me. In other words, that transaction happens without the market maker's involvement at all. Or the value of the basket falls down a bit and suddenly the market maker is selling at my 5018 and they trade against me.
So how do we know that the market maker is not ripping us?
So the simplest way, so frankly, we can look at it, we can check the price of the ETF, we can check the price of the index. The problem is with these more bespoke indices like the Core Top 50, I can't track that index. So I have to, the short answer is that if they're ripping us, so let's say that our basket is still the 50 rand and 28 cents, but let's say that we were...
Our index prices
It went down. I thought it went up.
Went down to 50.25.
Oh, dear.
3 cents lost.
3 cents.
But in front of my very eyes.
Let's say the fair value is 50.28, but they're ripping and they are actually so there's two ways they would rip us. The one is they would go a gigantic widespread. In other words, we would be buyers at 46 rand and sellers at 54 rand. In other words, we've got a 16% spread. And what do we do about that? Pick a better ETF. I mean, just quite simply. I don't know if the ETF issuers have SLAs with the JSC. I know it's been discussed. I don't know if
SLA is a service level agreement.
Yes. In other words, they will agree to a certain tightness of spread subject to liquidity in the underlying and et cetera, et cetera. And the offshore ones are more tricky. Right now, I can buy an S&P 500 ETF from a number of sources, but the S&P 500 is not trading. So it gets a bit wild and woolly sometimes. So if they just widen their spread to crazy levels, it's like, well, then the market's just going to run away from them. just go trade something else. But the other way, which people often say they'll rip them off, is that this thing is worth 50.28, but they're actually buyers at 52 and sellers at 52.50. In other words, they're buying above the price. So what I do is I arbitrage them. And that's the trick. If the ETF issuer has to be fairly honest in what they're doing, because if they're not honest in what they're doing, the market will arbitrage them and force them to be honest. And the reason we'll force them is because their dishonesty will cost them money. Mm. And that tends to focus the mind.
If you guys don't know what arbitraging is, we did an episode about it way back when.
Yeah.
Do you remember? It's like one of the first 4 or 5 episodes that we did.
Yeah, yeah.
Where we explain how that
works.
And
that's probably a bad example. It would be easier to do the arbitrage if they were buyers at 48 and sellers at 48.50. All I then do is I go buy at 48.50, which is a discount to the net asset value, which is silly for them to do. And I just go and exercise the ETF. If you've got a million ETFs, you can go to the issuer and say, here are my million ETFs. Please, sir, ma'am, can I have the shares?
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Do that. If an ETF issuer makes you really angry, please go do that.
I've seen it happen a few times. Yeah. And then there's the...
But then it's probably institutional investors that could do that.
Yeah, look, it's
probably
it's not
you and me.
Yeah. No. And then there's a last point. What you will see in the SENSE announcements is that they create and decreate and they use more fancy lingo. So when we did our IPO and we raised R1 billion, and that R1 billion doesn't go to our pocket. Remember, we had to go buy the shares. So we charged you a small fee, but we had to go buy the shares. But then, now we actually can't just buy R1 billion worth of shares. We've got to buy 1.1 billion because we've got to have ETFs to sell in the market. And then what happens is you want to sit with a certain amount, and 100 million would be too much. We would have, say, 10 million rand of stock of that ETF. But if we were net buying and suddenly we've got 20 million rands worth, well, then we go and decreate half of those by selling the shares.
Yeah, in other words, the underlying shares, the 36 shares that we have, we will go and sell back into the market.
The inverse is that what happens is everyone's been buying our ETF, and instead of having 10 million of stock, we've only got 2 left. So quickly we go and buy a whole lot more.
And so when people get super really nervous about the impact of ETFs on the market, this is why. Because there's suddenly, if your ETF fund becomes huge and you have to create 10 million new units, it means you have to go to the market and go buy all of those underlying shares, which then influences the supply and demand in the market. So suddenly the share price goes up because there's somebody buying a bunch of shares and there's not enough in the market or whatever.
Yeah.
And so this is why people get really nervous about the ETF industry, because as these funds grow, they start to impact price movements in the market as well.
Yeah. Although truthfully, if there's R1 billion going into the market, whether it goes in via an ETF, via an active fund damager, or whether it's just, Supersesius sitting at home in front of his computer buying shares on Easy Equities, it's $1 billion into the market. Mm. And its route to market is neither here nor there.
I get that, but I also understand how, because of how ETFs are priced, when you go into the market and you create a demand for shares there, it influences the price.
Oh, yeah. No, it absolutely does. And there are examples. And let me give you an example here. So Russell 2000 is literally, as it suggests, it's an index, mid-cap index in the US.
It sounds like a robot. This is my robot, Russell 2000.
Okay, so not quite. So what it is it is the mid-cap index in the US, and it's 2,000 shares in that mid-cap index.
So how many shares are in our mid-cap index?
60. Hey, our market
adorable.
Our market's about 450 shares.
Oh, it's so cute.
But that 2,000th share in that market is about 0.16%, okay, of the index. And if it were to fall out of the index tomorrow, the issuers who have those ETFs on that index need to go and sell it, right? Because it's no longer in the index. The problem is that the amount of money that is held in ETFs in that share, the quantum of shares that are held, is about 300 days of trading volume. So either they wait 300 days to exit it slowly over time, which they don't do. They go one day, that share gets crushed.
Mm.
The inverse is true as well. So one share got kicked out and got crushed. Another share pops in and it's, you know, and it price can suddenly... So,
but it seems like it would be very easy for the ETF issuers to trade that. Because if you know, if you are an ETF issuer, you know the bottom is going to fall, the bottom one is going to fall out, the price is going to get crushed. Why don't you just short it?
Well,
because that's like easy money, right?
Well, okay, so a couple of things. For the ETF issuer to short it, I don't know what the legalities are. I'm not sure if they're allowed to. Remember that they are... The problem with shorting is you still need to sell to a buyer. You know, you've got 300 days of volume you need to sell. If you try and short it and you want to then short 300 days of volume, it's going to take you 300 days to do. And you're net the same. The flip is that certainly, and less so these days, but back in the earlier days, is that when you know that there's going to be a change to an index and a stock is going in or out of the index and you know when it's going to happen, you can expect either if it's going in, perhaps there's going to be a bit of a run up in that share, and if it's going out, there might be a bit of a run down in that share. But our market's not quite that large, so it's not as important, the moves aren't as significant. And if you look at like the S&P 500, for example, that 500th share that would be dropping out is so small that there's not actually enough, you know, significantly enough action in it. But you will sometimes, and I think it was Sappi that recently dropped out of top 40, got kicked out because of size, or maybe it was process, I forget which reason. And on the day of, there was some selling in Sappi.
But the thing is, so when these shares get sold and when there's no liquidity in the market on these shares, because the company has already raised the money, they already got in the IPO, they already got the money that they wanted to get, it doesn't really affect the company in the world. So like Sappi continues to be Sappi, ShopRite continues to be ShopRite. It like when it's such a difficult thing to kind of bring home, but like the shares in the market have little to do with the company, the share price in the market.
So no, the share price in the market is of zero concern to the company unless executives are being paid shares as bonuses or options or something like that.
Or unless the company is buying it back. Sure, in which case correct. it would benefit them to buy it back when they fall out of the index.
Or unless someone's buying you, taking you over, in which case it would be better if it was cheap, more expensive. But those share prices don't matter. Now, I've been to some listed companies where you walk into the reception and the first thing you see is a giant screen indicating the share price. And that is a horrendous idea because those staff can do their best job in the world and the orange man tweeted and the share went down. So if you, the company cares naught for the share price. Yeah, if they want to raise capital, it matters. If they want to issue new shares, they want to buy them back. If they've been paid to executives, but from a performance metric, the share price is of zero interest.
And remember that a company, just in case you don't know this, a company would buy back shares in the market because when you sell a share, what you're actually doing is selling a little bit of ownership in your company.
Yeah.
So you want to buy that back because then you own a little bit more of your own company, which means you can keep more of the profit and et cetera. Because,
and that's an important point. When you sell a share, you're giving away perpetual rights to the profits of that company. So you get some money in, but you have given away profit forever. So when you buy a share back, it costs you a bit. But what you've actually done is bought back perpetual rights to profit.
To your profit.
Yeah.
And this is why people ask, so why would you invest in a share instead of going into a bond, for example? And that is because there's a limit to the amount of money you can make on a bond, but there's no limit to the amount of money that you can make on a share. So on the flip side,
the bond limit is no longer true because we now have negative interest rates. But
like in theory. And the flip side
in the olden days, like last year.
Yeah. The flip side is there's a limited amount of money that you can lose on a bond, and you can lose all of your money on a share, all of your investment on a share, not all of your money.
Sure.
Right? All right. Is there anything you want to add to Ben's? Oh, my God.
A lost point.
We're like 52 minutes in. I thought this was going to be such a quick one.
So I'll talk slowly and take it to 60. Or should I talk fast and take it to 52? So a last point, because someone out there is saying, so we got a billion ZAR from people and we went and we made a billion units and we sold them to our lovely users, et cetera. But we also bought a couple of million ZAR of extra units to have behind. Now we carried risk on that, right? So firstly, it means we need to have a balance sheet. We can't just, me and you can't do this and take our emergency fund, you know, a couple hundred thousand ZAR and go and start this. You need a couple of like real monies. But now we made some extra units and that cost us 50 million. But what happens if markets fall 30% and that's only now worth, 40 million or 35 million? Like we have lost money. So, ouch. So we would put a hedge on the position. So that if it falls, the hedge would make us profit. And if it rises, the hedge would lose us money, which means that we're not making money from the moves in the
shares.
Just
explain what a hedge is.
So a hedge would be in this case, and we would probably use an index future such as Aussie Futures, although we're not directly tracking it. A hedge is quite simply, it would be a short position. So we would go into the...
Way dumber.
I know, I'm coming, way I'm getting there. Dumber. I'm taking the long road.
Everybody just like died from fear.
I'm taking the long road around there. Basically, to your earlier point where you said, why don't they go and short the shares? What we would do as the ETF issuer is we would take a derivative short position in the market. So if the market fell, it would make us. We would be selling the market. If it fell, we would make a profit, and it would offset the loss in the ETFs that we hold. And if the market were to rise, we would make money in those ETFs, but we would have made a loss in our short position.
Would we need to take a derivative, or can't we just borrow the shares from ourselves?
We would take a derivative.
Why?
Because if we've borrowed the shares from ourselves, that just goes down a that goes
it's
down
like
a,
the infinite loop.
Yeah, that goes down a rabbit hole that like pops out somewhere in Mars, and then you're in trouble because we don't know how to get home from Mars yet. and you use derivatives because they're nice and cheap and stuff like that. And because we don't make money as an ETF issuer from the moves and the shares, we make money from managing the ETF and taking a turn.
But maybe this is also something that we should keep in mind as ETF investors, is that ETF issuers are for-profit companies. They're not doing it. They
yes,
to make money.
But their profit is coming from the management, not from the movement.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But there's a, like that, the spread and the tur, like all of that has to go to a for-profit company, and we don't begrudge them the profit because they make us the ETFs.
Yeah, we begrudge profit gougers, not profit.
Yeah.
Yes.
Unless of course, and we shop around for the cheapest one.
Unless of course we ever
this
become
is not a charity.
If we ever become a profit gouger, then we love them. if we could find a way to gouge profits.
Yeah, for ourselves.
Yes. Yes.
We are also a for-profit business. Each of us in our portfolios are a tiny for-profit business. Mm-hmm. So make sure that you gouge your profits.
Mm-hmm.
All right, let's get to Richard's. I want to get to Richard's feedback this week because it pertains to a newsletter that I wrote about Toyota Hiluxes, which got me into a lot of trouble. Somebody on Twitter said,
so you know what the most
you poke the bull supporter, you get the horns, and that's exactly what happened.
So I actually saw something today. Toyota Hilux is like the most sold SUV car in the country.
Yes, and so I got a great email about that this week, like not just in the country, but in the world. They are actually, it's such a high-selling car that they're actually like causing issues around the world because so many people have.
So they sold 3,565 in August.
That is insane. So there's 3,565 people in August who elected to forego.
No, don't go there. Shh.
To forego 10,000 rand a month for the rest of their lives. In 30 years' time,
so I'm renting a car at the end of the year. I wonder if I'm renting a Hilux.
Okay, hang on. Let me get to Richard's question before we run out of time.
I am too.
Richard's feedback before we run out of time. So he really needs a win. He had a Nissan Sentra, which he...
So you're not apologizing to the Hilux drivers?
Oh, no. No, I stand by my point. You can drive over me, but I stand by it.
And you can. You, when you're in traffic and you see a Hilux in your back mirror, I mean, you won't see a Hilux, right? You'll see a bull bar and a big Toyota, and you'll be thinking, if that's a Hilux, I'm in trouble. If it's a Land Cruiser, it's good. But if it's a Hilux, I'm fucked.
The thing is, from my car's vantage point, you can't see.
You just see the bull bar.
I just see wheels. There was a time where I lived for a few months. I commuted between Centurion and Joburg. I was between places and I stayed with a friend. And at New Year's Eve, my New Year's resolution was to get into a fist fight with a Hilux owner because they used to intimidate me on the road. And I was like, one day I'm just going to get out and I'm just going to go ape.
We have a mutual friend who says that the Hilux is the drug. Oh, yeah, he's scared of them.
Yeah. All right. So Richard traded in his Nissan Sentra for a Golf 7. which mm-hmm. so he bought the Nissan Sentra secondhand, was very sensible, sold it at a reasonable price. Then he got a Golf 7, and it all went swimmingly until his service plan ran out. He says, I upgraded the service plan to a maintenance plan, so I was covered. The maintenance plan cost 10,000 Rand for 5 years, which was absolutely worth it. So in this time, he also, like, he bought little extra mats and he washed his car himself. He took really, really good care of this car. He says, I noticed that during the services, they didn't seem to do much. This was Volkswagen.
Mm-hmm.
They did an oil change here and there, maybe a spark plug. I love the idea of them changing like one spark plug. He says, I got the feeling it was built to cost them nothing to service this car for 5 years. The car was built that way. He says, then the service plan expired and to extend it for a year would cost 15,000 Rand. So it's
for a year.
For a year. So 10,000 Rand for 5 years. And 15,000 Rand for a 1 year extension. So he's like, that seemed weird. I didn't extend and I paid for my next service. A couple of months ago, I noticed the car was using a lot of oil, like 1 to 4 pints per refuel. That's insane. He says, I asked them to check a few things out. So he took it back to the dealer to have them check it out. He says, so they ended up wanting to charge him 59,000 Rand to replace his piston and rods and 3,500 Rand to replace his boot lid, which I don't understand what that has to do with anything. He says, that is on a car with 73,000 kilometers on it. They added almost 1 Rand per kilometer driven. If I saved 1,000 Rand per month, it would take me 5 years to pay this off. That's more than the fuel bill over the same time period. Can you imagine? He said, what is 59,000 Rand is a great addition to my child's school fees or a nice holiday or a nice anything that will leave me with something better than what I had a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to touch on this because I wanted to point out that you can get a service schedule for your car. You can download a service schedule for your car on the internet, for all cars on the internet. Well, I didn't check every single one, but I'm assuming for all cars, you have access to what they are supposed to do with every service.
Yeah.
So when you take your car to a dealership, make sure that you get that service schedule and make sure that you cross-reference that with what they actually did
mm-hmm.
so that they don't do this to you. They don't just do like oil and spark plugs for five years. But and
that's,
then
for the first 5 years, that's about, I mean, your first big services kick in, depending on the car, at 80 or 120,000 only.
So what's so amazing.
Kilometers.
What's so amazing for me is my dad services my car now. So once I ran out of service plan, I had my dad do it. I need to, I'm coming up on 190,000 kilometers on my car now, and I need to replace the timing belt. So I'm like, I'm bracing myself. I'm like, this is going to be at least 3,500 Rand. No, the timing belt for my car is 750 Rand. Mm-hmm. And my dad is going to do mm-hmm. that for me. The other thing I wanted to say is when it comes to cars, the people who service them are a lot like people who sell financial products. Like, they rely on the fact that you don't know what's going on to intimidate you. So don't be timid. Like, when you go to have your car serviced, like, do your research before every service and make sure that you ask them. Like, be a pain. Be that person with the haircut who wants to speak to the manager. Just do it.
My wife got told not to come back once.
That's
so
awesome.
She was so difficult. When she then came a year later for them to service the car, they were like, no.
No, thank you. Go away. And then remember that you are the client. Like, even if you are an idiot and you know nothing about the car, you are the client. And you deserve to get the service that you are paying for. It's not a free service. You're paying for that.
And I like the idea that Richard went and fought with them and got price off. But also, me and you were having this conversation earlier in the week. So your car's old enough that it simply doesn't matter that it no longer has the stamp from what the Hyundai or whoever, and mine's at that, when a car's done, 90,000 kilometers, as long as it's been serviced. I mean, if you got a low mileage, then yes, people want to see that the dealership did it. At a high mileage, does the thing go?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The thing is, I've gotten to a point, and we've discussed this before, where the utility value of my car is much higher than the resale value,
mm-hmm.
which means that it would cost me a lot more to get from point A to point B if I had sold my car than if I held on to it.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's a really good way to think about this.
Yeah.
All right. I am, I have ignored 8 questions for this week because I thought we were quickly going to do the ETF pricing thing.
You didn't tell me to be quick.
I didn't. Like, I forget. And then it just goes past so quickly. Anyway, that's it from the Just One Lap team this week. Please remember that this is a show about questions. Send yours to ask@justonelap.com. You can also join the Fact Wallet community group on Facebook. Thank you to Aiden and Kay for being our community wizards. My name is Christopher Yedden. Thank you to Simon Brown. We'll catch you next week.